on the job, every minute counts. That's why Lowe's now has ProBlock Quick Dry Primer, expertly manufactured by Sherwin-Williams. Engineered for pros to dry fast and go on smooth for virtually flawless results that keep your job moving. It's available in oil and water-based, and getting it is easy. Order online by 2 p.m. and get free same-day delivery right to your job site. Lowe's, we help, you save. Orders placed after 2 p.m. will be delivered next day. Valid in select zip codes. Subject to driver availability. More terms apply.
Welcome to Needle Exchange, where we explore the stories behind the stitches. I'm Jamie Chalmers, aka Mr. X-Stitch, and today I'm interviewing Kirsty MacLeod. In this second part of my Needle Exchange, we enter the heart of her Red Dress project, something featuring 380 embroiderers from 51 countries. Each panel, a story of identity, resilience, and culture. Kirsty reflects on the power of needlework as a universal language, the profound emotional encounters sparked by the dress, and its future, both as a museum piece and a digital archive. This is a story of collaboration, legacy, and art without borders. And if you're unaware of the Red Dress Project until now, you're in for a treat. It's truly something profound. If this story resonates with you, then my Needle Exchange with Vanessa Maher, the founder of the Domestic Dusters Project, might be worth a listen. That's episodes 79 and 80. But I'm very grateful for Kirsty taking the time to chat with me. As I say, this project is quite something and I don't think it's finished yet. I know you're going to enjoy it. And if you do enjoy it, please leave a review on your favourite podcasting platform so that it helps other people discover our conversations. I'll be back next week with somebody else from the world of needlework. But until then, enjoy the show. I think of the dress, if I may, as it's kind of like an infographic. It's kind of like a map. I know that there is a book about the dress which tells the story of the dress, and there's something to be said for, I'll put it as a question to you then, because the dress, I don't think, can continue to travel the world. The dress probably needs to be somewhere, doesn't it, so that people can see and sit it. How do you envisage it being consumed by people thereafter? Like, do people look at it and accept it for themselves? Are you going to provide a guidebook that explains the whole of the dress? Have you worked all that sort of stuff out?
So my plan is to retire her in 2030, and I'm at the moment trying to find the right museum in England for her to go to. So there's, we've kind of got exhibitions booked up until then. I mean, there are pockets, but there's, it's kind of, yeah, all she's just going to be carrying on doing her museum tours. And within that time, so my whole focus now is on documentation and preservation. So the book was the first part. The next thing is the digital embroidery archive. So the whole dress will be completely catalogued and archived. And that will be linked to the digital red dress, which exists. It was created by Bath Spa University 2 years ago. So you can go and interact with this incredible 3D version. So the idea is that you can then zoom into the embroidery, click on it, and then it will take you into this whole page where it will tell you everything about that particular embroiderer and embroidery and have images and everything. Because unless I'm there, that's the thing that's kind of missing, is that, because you people want to be able to say, like, what is that? Why was it made? And when was it made? And what's the threads and all these things? So, yeah, sometimes exhibitions do have images around and books and things to try and, you know, give some of the detail. But obviously there's 380 motifs, so it's vast. So that's the next thing. And then the final bit before I can then rest is the film. So there are three short films already, but there's currently 200 hours of footage from the last 4 years being collected, which will go into a final edit. But we're just going to wait until there's a few more exhibitions that really need to be in there, like Rwanda next year, hopefully, and Vietnam. And probably the last exhibition should be in there as well. That's going to be epic in Massachusetts, all going well. Yeah, so it's all kind of in process, but it's important because there'll be a time, probably not that far in the future, where the dress will have to go behind glass again, and then after that she'll be back in a drawer in a box or something. So she's not being worked on anymore. The actual creation journey finished 2 years ago, but we are still traveling. Well, she mainly is still traveling a lot. And the wear and tear is significant. Like, every few months I'll sit and just kind of strengthen up seams, and especially it's the button and loops on the bodice. But obviously, like, the conservation now has become quite serious. So whereas in the first few years, you know, I was very slapdash and nonchalant about everything. I mean, I didn't know what she was going to become, but now it's all white gloves and temperature regulated, and, you know, but she still has to be rolled up, put into a box, you know, taken somewhere and then rolled up again. And, you know, it's a lot.
So the thing that started my rambling, I think it was a question, was this thing about the, and I'm glad that there's more film footage, because I think that was the thing I was thinking about, is just the moments in which people realize the stories that surround the piece that they're working on. Like, that's some powerful moments. It sounds like you've been able to document those. I think that's going to be quite a profound thing. Must have been quite the thing to go through at the time.
Yeah, I mean, the documentation is pretty varied, and it always has been. Up until I've been able to travel with the dress, it was just left up to the embroiderer or the charity that supported the embroiderers. And obviously that's going to vary a lot. But yeah, so now whenever we go and do a trip, then there's usually, well, there is now people kind of filming and photographing. But even that, like, almost like the best thing would be for me to have a camera on my head and just I'm the one that's very blessed that I get to experience, you know, these conversations and these interactions, and there's not always a camera there. But I guess, yeah, I mean, it's words, isn't it? That's up to me to make sure I can share as much of that as possible. And I've got lots of voice recordings too, which are lovely. Sometimes I'm just like, hang on, let me just record this, get it all out. But sometimes that's just been totally inappropriate. And obviously there are moments and conversations and I've had where it's just, you know, I don't want anywhere near us, you know, it's far too vulnerable and exposing and tender. And so, yeah, there's definitely enough documentation to provide a good enough experience of what it has been like working with the dress.
Yeah. Because I was thinking of this analogy, like, when I was a kid, I played Final Fantasy VII video game, right? It took me 150 hours, but there was a book that told you how to do the whole thing. And that was great, because that was what I was able to do. But at the same time, it was a massive open world. And really, if I'd have thought about it now, I would have just meandered through it in some kind of Zen-like way and found my way as would naturally lead me or something. And I was reflecting on that in terms of the dress, because you've got so many different motifs and you've got the opportunity for people to look at the book and potentially work through them chronologically or something like that. But I feel like the beauty of the dress and one of the services it provides is this kind of Zen-like opportunity for people to curate their own story, just even by the drifting of their eyes down the piece, you know, and they will find their ways and they will see things, I'd imagine, initially that just visually catch their eye, but maybe that will lead on to another piece, will lead on to another piece, and then there'll be a story that will stop them in their tracks and that sort of thing. And I feel like that's probably one of the most beautiful things that's going to come out of that dress, is the personal journey people take with it.
Yeah, I think so. And the energy that you can feel from the dress, like, even if you don't understand what you're looking at, there's a palpable energy of intention and unity, which a lot of people burst into tears in the presence of the dress. A lot of people maybe take a while to come too close because they find it too overwhelming. And there was even a young lady once at an exhibition who just stood like this for 20 minutes just in front of her, and she just said to me afterwards, like, I just had to go and absorb that energy. I feel so pumped right now. It's just beautiful.
You can't predict that sort of stuff when you're starting
absolutely
out in a Perspex
not.
Box, can you? Not at all. No, that's amazing. No. There have been, is it 7 people that have worn the dress?
It's actually more now. I think it's 20.
Okay, that's completely wrong. It's
26, I think, now.
Okay.
Yeah.
What can you say about the people that have worn the dress? Because you're not just, like, I couldn't wear it. I mean, physicality notwithstanding, but can you talk to that?
Yeah, so it's for the embroiderers, really, or people that have contributed to the project in some way. I get a lot of people asking to wear the dress for weddings, proms. I even got a message from a princess in Madagascar wanting to wear it to her coronation.
Oh,
I just
wow.
say no. Yeah. There was also performers wanted to wear it. Was it for the Olympics or one of theatrical dance pieces, whatever? You know, there's just so many people that want to wear her.
Just as an aside, did your salt mine lady friend, did she ask to wear it?
Oh, she hasn't actually. Well, she'd look great in it. But no, she has stitched on it. She has stitched, yeah. So she would qualify.
Excellent.
And the curator in the Bosnia and Herzegovina exhibition, she wore the dress, which was very, very powerful. Saranda Bavetsky, the deputy head of parliament in Kosovo, who is connected to the women that stitched on the dress in Kosovo, wore the dress. Otherwise, it's the embroiderers that have worn it.
And there's a lot of symbol. I've seen a few photos because there are plenty of photos in the book, isn't there? And as you said, there's something about the construction of the dress. There's a posture that it delivers, and it's that, there's like a goddess quality.
Quite a little bit regal as well. But
in the right kind of way, you know, like a sort of the regality of a Mother Earth or something along those lines.
Yeah. Well, you stand tall. So the top of the skirt as well is also boned with a huge waistband because of the weight of the skirt. So you've got that, and then you've got the boning in the bodice. So you really do stand. It's not uncomfortable, but you stand tall. And I think it's just the feeling of, actually, for me initially, it was a very overwhelming feeling, and it was about a bit too much. It was just the energy and the voices and all the other embroiderers all there, and you're wearing it, you're at the center, they're all around you, they're surrounding you. And I haven't worn the dress for ages, but if I wore it now, I think I'd be fine with that. But at times that can be a lot, but it's beautiful because I think without exception, all of the embroiderers that have worn the dress, they all say, I just feel so empowered, and I feel so connected to all the women. And a lot of them do not want to take the dress off. It's often because after a while I'm like, oh, I should probably get it. It's like trying to do it subtly at the beginning. And then the funniest was Charmin from Iraq. She's there,
right,
who I connected with in Swansea. She's supported by a charity there. And she really didn't want to take off the dress at all, and she still says, we're still in touch, and she still says, that was the best day of my life. Like, even, and she's married, she's had a wedding. But it was all about the dress. Yeah.
There's a real, isn't there, if you want to get a bit hippie about it. I mean, if you think about the amount of hours that people have put in, even I did a project where with the charity, it was called Stitch for Syria, and people just had to cross stitch this little Lebanese design, and they were brought together to create wall hangings. We had, I can't remember how many we had. We might have had like 2,000, but I could be wrong on that. Yeah. And we ended up with like these really big, colourful wall hangings. And we went to Beirut and took them to this. It was kind of a refuge where women would go, and they would do needlecraft. And it was like Lebanese women, but also Syrian refugee women who, you know, they were just on the border. It really wasn't very far away, but they would be able to come and do this work and have their children in a creche and allow the stitching and the community to dissolve the world around them, which was a really like necessary thing, you know, just giving them a break for that. But reflecting back on the fact that every single person who'd made one of these things, and it might have only taken them an hour to stitch it, but that's an hour of good intention that's powered into that piece of fabric, isn't it? You know, and then you put that, and if you take that and you, put it into a dress in those kind of situations, that's what I love. And to go back to a point I made before, you can stop and look at it and go, oh, it's a dress with embroidery. But it doesn't take you long to be like, holy crap. Like, you know, that's not a very elegant phrase, I admit. But the gravity of it, you know?
Yes. And I think also what's often noticed is the fact that it's not all created by professional embroiderers. So the majority is people that have experience with stitch. But there's lots of kids that have worked on the dress. I also took the garment to a mental health centre in Podiev in Kosovo, where four of the women stitched on the dress, and you know, they're pretty sedated and struggle to even hold a needle, and you know, they've stitched on it too. So I think that also is a different thing, like when you go close and you see like, oh, that's not, you know, that's very different to that, and that's very There was a lady once at an event in England who really couldn't understand that. She said, why on earth would you let someone that can't embroider, you know, go next to that panel, which was the one in Australia, which is very refined and exquisite. And I said, well, because this project is about like authentic voice and about expression, and it's not to do with how good or not you are at embroidery, and you don't have to have technical expertise. It's just purely about expression and voice. And she said, I don't understand. You know, for her, this dress needed to be perfect. And I said, well, you can go to many museums around the world and you can see a perfectly embroidered dress, and it's all, you know, aligned and Colour Perfect and Stitch Perfect, but this is not that. This is, you know, this is real. This is authentic. It's messy. It's not trying to be something else that it's not. This is what it is like to be a human in this time. Yeah.
And the fact that it elicited that question from the lady reinforces the value of having that piece in there in the first place, right?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Definitely. Yeah. I love a good pattern interrupt on something just for making people be like, yeah, no, it's fantastic. So, and then there are offshoot projects, right? I'm thinking of like the Calico Garment Initiative.
Yes, actually three more were confirmed yesterday, so I'm feeling very...
At Lowe's, this Veterans Day and every day, verified military members, veterans, and their spouses get automatic silver status in MyLowe's Rewards with free standard shipping, plus 10% off eligible purchases with no annual limit. It's one way we honor and give back to those who have served and still do. Learn more now at Lowe's.com/military. 10% discount can't be combined with another offer. Exclusions, terms, and conditions apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at Lowe's.com/terms. Subject to change.
Excited about that. So there are currently now 15 cloaks and dresses in creation around the world. Three are finished in the US. So they were originally offered to venues that exhibited the red dress as a way for outreach, really, that they could create their own collaborative garment. And it was also at the time when the dress was kind of finishing and being completed. Quite a few people wrote to me quite upset that I was bringing the project to a close. And I really realized that there has been for years, it's not just through this project, but there is such a need for community and collaboration, and that with the completion of the red dress, how about we start something new, but not something that I would be managing and organizing necessarily. So Gail and I create the garment. Each group can either have it sewn up entirely or in pieces. So it depends how they want to organize the creation. And yeah, so it basically invites any community to create this garment in collaboration over whatever period of time they want to. Often places where the dress goes will take one on and it's exhibited as part of that exhibition. So they have the red dress and then they have their Vermont dress, you know, in the next room or alongside. So it's inviting this kind of, I guess it's in a way, it's kind of like becoming part of the red dress project, but in their own way. But excitingly, it's bringing that community together. And like with the red dress, but also with every other community garment I've ever heard about or all through the Calico Garment Initiative, it's this incredible coming together. It's this connecting. It's this healing. It's this sharing of stories. And everyone always says how powerful it was and how this has happened and how this has happened and now this person's doing this and this is going to happen and they're going to go and do this. And I mean, it just fills me with so much joy when I hear this. It's like how one little garment, you know, and this shared intention and this shared focus can create these incredible ripples of togetherness and support and upliftment. So yeah, so there's a cloak in Ecuador, there's a dress in India, there's three dresses in the US. I think there could be another three coming soon. There's two dresses in England and a cloak. There's a dress in South Africa. So I think a lot of these will probably take many, many years to be created. But I've said to them all, we've got an exhibition almost confirmed in Massachusetts. It will be the last exhibition before the red dress retires for 7 months in the Fuller Craft Museum, all going well. So that's, we're going to bring the dress and then all the garments together and have a really big exhibition of everything. And I think that will be, I think I'll be in tears for most of that exhibition, just being in that space. Yeah, I think it will just, even imagining it now, I feel a bit fluttery. Just, yeah, it's beautiful to kind of, yeah, I guess, be at the centre through working with the red dress of just so much community collaboration and seeing the magic of that.
Yeah. For a second there, I thought maybe you need to make yourself a new dress that you can sit in a chair and literally cry for 7 months. But I don't feel like you're the same person to do that anymore. Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah, just dissolving with your own tears over time. Sit there naked afterwards. with the Calico garments, and you may have said this, and sorry if you did and I missed it, but are they given a particular steer about the way that what it should reflect or anything like that?
So it's really up to the venue. I always, most people would take on how I did the red dress, which is, yeah, to create a piece that represents identity and culture, and just giving them that prompt of what would you like to share with the community, with the world. And yeah, some venues, they ask a lot of questions. They want to know about, you know, thread type and stitch type and everything. And others just totally do their own thing. But it's very, very open. And I say, like, dye it. If you want to dye it, paint on it. You know, the Massachusetts dress is completely covered in crochet, you know. So the one in India, I believe, is going to be painted with Karnatakan earth from South India. So it's going to be like a rust red, orangey color. The one in Wales has been part dyed and wowed. So it's blue, got blue in it. The one in Ecuador is pink. So they dyed it. So, yeah, it really is up to the... up to the venue and or the groups. So it was originally museums, and then I opened it up to anyone. So there's stitch groups, there's even a group of friends doing one in a cloak in England somewhere, charities, you know, whatever, whoever wants to just take part. And then I push it through. I have a dedicated page on the website now, so everyone gets their own page, and then I push it through all the Red Dress channels. So yeah, just try and get them lots of exposure as well.
Right. Have you heard of Liz Konecki? She's a needlework artist who, among other things, does embroidered maps. She takes maps to communities and she will embroider the streets and certain elements and then invite people to stitch their own landmarks and points of interest. So you get this kind of like crowdsourced geographic infographic, if you like, of an area.
Oh, no, I haven't. I'm going to write that down. Liz Konecki.
Yeah. She's Needle Exchange podcast, insert podcast number here. I'm so good at that. But because it was just making me think, there's all these little things that keep popping into my head. You know, I love the fact that, as you said earlier, with the lady who spotted the needlework from a certain place, it made me think about one of the things I love about lace and how geographically specific it is and how you get all these subtle nuances. So then you're getting that with the calico garments in some ways, aren't you? Because you're allowing localized variation of a similar kind of form. And then, like with Liz's piece, and then this will make sense. In a village hall where my daughter goes and does ballet on a Saturday morning, they made a needlework map of the place 25 years ago. Little collaborative things. Sometimes there's a cross-stitched house. Sometimes there's a little textile building here, but a way of like reflecting the town then. And then they subsequently did it about 2 years ago as well. So they've got these two maps that are made of needlework. And that's the same thing again, isn't it? The people coming together to reflect their place. And there's a certain naivety to those pieces, which is charming. Liz's work is a bit more, I guess she's overseeing the curation of it. People are still stitching what they want to stitch to their ability. But all of these things present local flavors, and in some ways the format, like saying it's got to be a map, that dictates, a certain language. And then what I love about your opportunity is you're presenting this object that can be used for local expression, but is an unorthodox mode of language because it's an item of clothing. So, but do you know what I mean? It's interesting because you're just allowing people to provide these local flavors, aren't they? And you're just saying, reflect the culture, reflect the identity. Tell me about the place that you are at right now using this dress as a form of language. It will be interesting to see how they come out. As you say, they're already being dipped in their local flavors and stuff like that. I wonder.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I think it's, I mean, do you see it along those lines?
I mean, yeah, I can relate to everything you just said.
Phew, I thought I was talking gibberish for a minute.
I'm thinking specifically about the the Indian dress, for instance. They have so many different styles. The plan with that one is it's going to go around the whole country, so they're going to have so many diverse styles of embroidery on there. They already do. They're down in the south at the moment. They've got Lambani work, and then they've got much more kind of like silk shading-y type work going on. And but the dress in South Africa, so I was there with the dress last year, and after a presentation I did about the project, a lady came and spoke to me, and she was in floods of tears, and she just said, I have to initiate a calico dress. This is what this country needs. We have to bring this country together. It's just everything is awful. It's just, this is what we need. So her intention with that is, I think, far less about the embroidery. It's literally all about the process and about how she's going to bring all these kind of disparate groups. And it's going to be, you know, having been there, but only for 2 weeks, it's going to be a challenge, but I know she'll do it, and it will be, you know, I'm sure it will be an incredible experience. And at the end of it, you know, to have this, this garment of togetherness, you know, with the whole country, all these different groups represented, will be epically powerful. And then, yeah, so the other thing with what you were just saying is, so beautifully, what's going on a lot, particularly with the Welsh dress, is that there, a lot of the work has been added by refugees and asylum seekers. So as well as getting the Welsh, more kind of traditional Welsh stitching, and you're getting stitches from Afghanistan, and you're getting stitches from Nigeria as well, which is incredible. So a lot of these garments will also have that diversity. It depends on the venue and how it's being worked, I think. So I think for the Indian one, for instance, it's being run by Hampi Art Labs, which is funded by the JSW Foundation. So I think for them, they're going to be working within art spaces, but also with all the local women that they support through various initiatives. So theirs will stay very much Indian, I think. Mm. The Welsh one is very focused on working with charities. So theirs will be very multicultural. So it will be fascinating to see them. And all the three that have finished in America, they're completely different. Completely different. Right. You see them. And they're in this, you know, the same continent. So yeah, it'll be fascinating.
And then they're all made by humans.
All made by humans, yeah. Yeah, with a shared intention.
Yeah, and with no borders.
No borders, yeah. And men with children, you know, there's I think that's, hopefully that's being carried through. I would imagine it will be without me even asking, but there is no prejudice or borders or anything. It's just, you know, it's open to everyone within their community.
I mean, it's a fairly remarkable thing, isn't it? I don't know. I've done a couple of things, like even just opening up this little gallery here. And I remember when we put the sign on the door, because literally within a week, we turned an empty shop into an art space. And I remember when the sign went up on like day five and I got a bit emotional because suddenly I realised what was going on for a second or whatever. As you said to yourself, you can't dwell in that emotion for long. But I mean, you must have had some moments. Are there any particular standout things where you were just like the scale of it, or, you know, what's...
Yeah. So I think probably there was just the general overwhelm at what the project was becoming and the importance of the voices and the like a feeling of responsibility and pressure. So that was the kind of first challenging thing that came in, along with trying to find funding. But then once I was kind of like actively going places and connecting with individuals and groups and charities, then that brought a whole level of experience that I completely had no idea would ever come. You know, with the dress, you know, I've managed to connect with communities and individuals I would never have been given access to. For instance, the Bedouin community in Egypt, Sinai, in the middle of the desert, women living in poverty, supported by an initiative called Fansina. So I was with Salima, the founder, you know, her four-wheel drive, driving around, you know, all the mountains and the hills, delivering materials to women in tiny remote little kind of shacks in the middle of nowhere, and, you know, connecting with them and watching them stitching, and you know, it's not much language exchange, but it's all kind of, you know, touch and signs and gestures and smiles and hugs. And then, you know, the incredibly difficult but so important trips to Kosovo, Bosnia and Herzegovina, connecting with survivors. And in Bosnia and Herzegovina, particularly with the survivors of conflict-related sexual violence, and being, we were there to shine a light on this incredibly important exhibition that was created and dedicated to 15 survivors. And it was 30 years on from what they had experienced, this was their time to share what had happened to them. The exhibition was like being hit in the face several times. It was video testimonials. It was large body maps they'd done with therapists and psychiatrists. It was absolutely, like, it completely floored me, the whole experience. And the day before the exhibition opens, I was blessed to be able to have time with the women to show them the dress. And then they stitched this collaborative motif onto it together, which is BH, Bosnia Herzegovina, from victim to victory. And then they've each put their initial around the outside. But even that, so this is the day before they are about to open this exhibition, where they are about to share their voices, which have been silenced for 30 years. You know, just being a part of that, witnessing them, those women, those 15 incredible women, and going through that process, And a lot came with that. Like, you know, one woman collapsed, ambulance, you know, there was a lot of emotion. There was a lot of, I guess, fear, you know, there was so much. And then the opening exhibition next day, I mean, it was so well attended, and it just did what it needed to do. I had all the people that needed to be there. It had the right people speaking. It had testimonial. It had some of the women speaking as well. But the whole thing was just, it was just so hard. It was so hard to witness. It was so hard to understand what they had been through and had been suffering with for 30 years. I think, you know, like in lots of the places that I've been to, there has not been the support needed for these individuals. Kosovo too, you know, a lot of the people I met still massively in PTSD, still not really being supported in the way that they need to. So there's this frustration, and then it really kind of, it's difficult to, you know, where do I fit in within this? What's happening? Like, and how am I there, and what can I do to help? But actually, you know, is it my place, and how far can I step forward? And I remember before I arrived, apparently the women said to the charity worker, we're not interested in this. Like, what does this British woman have any sense of? She doesn't know what we've been through. And the charity lady said that they said to them, give her a chance. She wants to come and show you the stress. I think you'll be interested. Just let her come and see what you think. And sure enough, when I arrived, there was just no acknowledgement of me being even in the space. They just looking the other way. But as soon as I set the dress up and I began to share the stories from the dress, you know, they all came forward, and they were so interested. And then as soon as I was beginning to talk about Kosovo, Rwanda, you know, they were completely riveted. And then they were completely engaged, and they were, you know, so focused on the stitching, and it was a beautiful experience. So it's just like, I'm not a therapist, but I need to be able to hold space, and I need to be able to in the moment, you know, make the right decisions. And often it's involving a lot of people who are very vulnerable. So yeah, that's been a learning. I began to go to counseling after Kosovo to try and, first of all, help me integrate my experiences better, and also tend to the triggers it was bringing up in me, but also to learn how to hold space, how to look after myself in these situations, and be able to hold space for others. So yeah, it was a process, but I think, you know, by each trip it got a little bit more familiar, as it were. And I never thought I'd be doing that kind of work. I mean, I was a fine artist in a gallery, and suddenly I'm in here, and so it's been a learning curve.
What's kind of curious is it makes me feel as though the dress is the therapist.
Yeah.
You're the concierge, aren't you?
Yeah. I think so. I think that she has a healing power, definitely has a healing power, and it worked on me for quite a few years. And I remember various events. Anytime there was a specific event where the dress and I were together, I'd often be ill, and I was just going through all these processes all the time, and it was just really full on. Thankfully, I'm in a different space now, but often when the dress is with someone for a period of time, maybe it's a museum or the invigilator sitting with the dress or the museum shop owner or whatever, people will go through stuff. People will get ill. Stuff comes up, you know, to be healed. So yeah, over the last few years, I really truly believe that the dress has got her own healing power, and I'm not sure how it works really, but I think my job is to just keep the space clear for that, obviously look after her entirely and make the right decisions. You know, I had to get good at doing that too. Like, I was in my younger years quite a people pleaser in lots of ways. And when it comes to the dress now, I'm able to make very quick, very clear decisions. And it's like, no, that's not going to work. You know, there has to be a different way. No, that's not enough space. Yeah, no, lighting's not going to work. You know, so I can be quite, I'm very clear on that now. Right, I'm very protective. There was a situation earlier this year, I better not name names, where this venue that we were meant to be doing something with behaved appallingly and had this... changed this whole agreement that we had and where she was going to be exhibited, and it was not in any way appropriate for the dress in any way. It was not even big enough, but because of where it was, there was this general feeling that I should compromise, and I said no, there's no way. I have all the voices of the survivors and the women in that dress. I'm not going to be squashing the dress into any small space. So yeah, that's also been important, because it's not just me, it affects so many people. I think that's why I can do it. There's 380 of us.
Yeah, you're like the mum to 380 kids. I was thinking it's a bit like being like Mozart's mum. When you're the parent of something that is remarkable, like, and then you think, well, I need to protect that remarkability, but at the same time allow it to flourish somehow.
Yeah, not be too controlling. That's the thing. Mm. Yeah, getting that lightness of touch, but also firm boundaries. Yeah. Mm.
So now there's a book. We should just touch on the book. Let's talk about the book for a second.
Yeah.
Tell us about the book.
Yeah. So the book has been many, many years in waiting. Loads of people asked me for years, please make a book. I was like, I'd love to, just, you know, so just trying to find the right publisher, the right time. So after about a year of just nothing moving, nothing happening, I found Quickthorn online, who focus entirely on books to do with craft and well-being. So I was like, well, that sounds like a
good
thing. Yeah. And then, yeah, all their books are fully compostable. Obviously, you don't want to be composting them, but they're completely, you know, earth-friendly, sustainable. They're printed in the UK, not shipped off to Asia like most publishers do. So straight away, it was like, right, email Quickthorn. And I got a reply within a few hours. And Katie Bevan, who runs it, said, oh, I know the red dress. I've been following the dress. And yeah, let's have a Zoom. And it was all just happened. But I had in my mind lots of things I wanted to do, like commissioning essays from contributors to the project, like having the designer that I've worked with on the website do the design, all these kind of things that were quite, you know, additional costs that Quickthorn couldn't support. They do the bulk of it. They do, you know, they do a book, but I wanted all these extras. So I was like, okay, I'll raise the money. So I did a crowdfunder to raise the additional, I think it was 12 grand that we needed to do it in the way that I wanted to do the book. And we got it, which was brilliant. A lot of it through pre-selling the book, which worked well. So the book is, the idea of the book is that it kind of echoes the dress, and that it's lots of different voices and perspectives and places all come together to kind of create the story of the red dress. So I do have a chapter in there, and my chapter is kind of a bit more emotional and personal about my experience in guiding the dress. Then there's the embroidered stories. There's these essays about issues that the dress brings up for people. So maybe it's finding voice, feminism, healing through trauma with embroidery. And then, you know, lots of lovely pictures and stitch diagrams and all sorts, really. So it's very, very multi-layered. And it was, you know, massive shout out to Emma Bovill, who is my editor, who really helped me to distill the information and just put it all together. And without her, I would have really struggled, because it's just vast, you know, the amount of content that I have. But it was difficult to choose which embroiderers to focus on. You know, I couldn't do them all. I would have loved to have. I mean, it would be like 50 books if I did that. But it was a great process. It all just flowed. Once it was in action, it just all flowed very well. And then it was released in May, I think, of this year. So it's a hardback, a softback, and an ebook version. So trying to make it as accessible as possible. And yeah, it's going really well. I've been doing lots of book talks, and I do lots of events anyway. So wherever I go, I bring books, and yeah, they're selling really, really well. And it's just lovely to have that out there now, you know, that I can say, yep, that's the story. There it is. You know, it's all on the website, but it's hard, you know, there's a lot on there, and it can take hours to find what you need. But with the book, it's all, you know, it's all printed and all there.
Yeah. And I think one of the lovely things about the book, and it is a lovely book, is just it provides people the opportunity to repeatedly consume things. You know, no one's really going to go and stare at the dress 15 different times, like ever, pretty much. You know what I mean? Like, it takes some commitment. At least the book affords that opportunity, so you really can like sink your eyes, teeth into it and get underneath it in a way. So I think it's a perfect accompaniment, that plus a digital red dress, I guess, for the opportunity to look at it when you can't see it in real life. That's a nice trifecta.
Trifecta. I've not heard that word. That's a great word.
Yeah. Thanks. I think that might be my word of the day all of a sudden now. That's great. And if people want to find out about the Red Dress Project, pick up the book and all of the other stuff, where is the best place for them to go?
The website has everything. It's fast and updated all the time. So it's reddressembroidery.com. I also am very active on my Instagram account, which is all pushed through into Facebook. So if you're either on those two platforms as well, yeah, very, very prolific. And then I do a monthly newsletter now, which is good, which I've never done before. I'm on just on my third one. So that's great. I can just get everything concisely in for the next month, which is super.
I think that's perfect. That's a great way, isn't it? Because that gives people an opportunity to ask you questions as well that you can kind of reply to and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So can't beat a newsletter. That's And I mean, I would say as well, it's worth following you on Facebook because it's nice to have something nice to look at on Facebook.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to get too into that conversation now. Cool. Right. It seems a bit daft now to go, let's talk about your favorite things, but I'm going to do it anyway because that's what I have to do on this podcast or whatever. So as a child of the world, I'm interested in your answers here, but let's start with, do you have a favorite band / album?
So it's changed so much. At the moment, Stick Figure is my favorite, the kind of reggae. When I was in my 20s, it would be Massive Attack, Mezzanine. You know, that was my key album. When I'm working or just around and about doing stuff, I just put on world music compilations. So that's probably what I listen to mostly. And also Ajit Kaur, her kind of Shunya chants, so lots of kind of meditative chants. And so, yeah. And then I also love drum and bass music, and I'm relearning to mix it at the moment. So when I was when I was in my 20s, I used to mix vinyls, Technics. I mean, never to a standard where I'd be playing out, you know, but I used to make tapes and stuff. And now my boys are a bit older, they're 10 and 8, and I'm got more headspace, and I've just refound my love for drum and bass music, and went out with my sister to a big rave in Bristol in February, which was just so fun. It's been 20 years since I've been out on a night out. So now I'm all trying to relearn how to mix, which is just fun. But obviously drum and bass is not for your everyday, you know,
it's easy to mix either, let's be honest, isn't it? Yeah.
It's not at all easy to mix. It's very tricky, but I love it. Yeah. I think it's the intensity and the bass and everything. It's so visceral, isn't it? And so, I mean, I've just always loved it since I was about 17. So that's fun. But probably what world music at the moment and Stick Figure are what's played most in my phone.
Yeah, I used to be well into drum and bass for a little while. I used to listen to the Hospital Radio podcast. And it is hard to mix. It's interesting because of the way YouTube algorithms work and because of the stuff that's going on here. I have a lot of people playing house music mixes and stuff.
Yeah.
Because one of the things I'm trying to do in the town, there's these shipping containers with a big screen in the center of town that we should hopefully be managing soon. And I want to build a DJ booth inside there so that people can play mixes that can go out on the big screen and they can play to the town, but we can also hopefully stream them in different directions and that sort of thing. And yeah, so I see a lot of people, but house music, four on the floor, nice and easy to mix. Any bugger can do that, whereas drum and bass,
yeah,
all over. I love it. I love the swing of it. I like a good swing on a bit of drum and bass as well.
Yeah, you can really dance.
You drive a bit faster than you should as well.
I have to be careful when I listen to it in the car because it makes me so pumped and wild.
Yeah, I could never really do cross stitching while drum and bassing. It's a bit like trying to cross stitch if you're listening to waltz music or doing a spin class to waltz music. You just can't because you just fall off the bike at some point. The rhythms are all around. So that sound okay. And then let's do books. I feel like books. I bet you're going to be. I'm going to write down because what I have a habit of doing now, as some people might know, is if someone recommends a really good book, my wife's going to get it for Christmas or a birthday. So I've got my pen at the ready with you.
Yeah, so I mean, straight away, my favorite book ever, ever, ever is Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse, which is absolutely just, I've read it so many times, listened to it on audiobook. It's I think the closest thing for me to understand about what life is. I just love it. And it's all set in India. And I feel like in another life, I was in India. And then a book I've just finished reading, which I highly recommend, is The Untethered Soul. Which is absolutely, it's life-changing. It really is. It's beautiful.
Is that fiction?
No, it's, I guess it would be self-development, kind of life skills, spirituality. Yeah, it's just so beautifully written and really accessible, because I can't get through dense, pithy analysis. Like, I've tried quite a few books, and you know, when I really want to read, because I really want to understand like philosophy and theory and stuff, I literally can't get through the text, or like every two words I have to get a dictionary out. Whereas with The Untethered Soul, it's, you know, it's really like intense sharing, but it's just so lightly and beautifully written, so I could get it, which I really appreciated. Yeah.
Do you ever read The Tao of Pooh?
No, but I've heard of it. Yeah.
It's like Taoism through the filter of Winnie the Pooh, and there's the tea of Piglet or whatever. Like, I like a bit of Taoism. Like, to me, that's like my right kind of ballpark, because it's not too like human or whatever. But I always like the layer. I haven't read it in a long time, but the layer of that, and then you're just like, oh my God, I think A.A. Milne was a genius. Yeah. But he's just the person who's interpreted it has done a really good job of it. You know, like, that's a very satisfying read, that. Yeah, that's all right, that is. I've got a question to come back to off the back of that, but before that, favorite film?
Right, so it's tricky because there's quite a few, but the one that came to mind straight away is The Notebook, which is a romance film. Must have been
made.
It's
got Keanu Reeves in it.
No, it's got. No. I don't even know what his name is. He's got. It's a really beautiful, poignant love story. And I'm always in floods at the end of it. So yeah, I often watch that. In terms of more recent years, The Life of Pi blew my mind. Okay. I mean, yeah, I've not read the book. I did try. I couldn't start it. I really love that. I love being taken on a journey, a visual kind of expansive journey of kind of awakening and consciousness. I found that amazing. But I love really.
It's what you do for a living, if you don't mind.
I love watching nature documentaries. That's probably, if I get time, I would often, you know, all about the solar system and the universe. I'm very interested in that. So, like, I'm not at all academic, but I'm fascinated with physics and light mm-hmm. and energy and particles and Big Bang theory and cosmos. Yeah, I love all that.
It turns out it was Ryan Gosling.
Oh, that's it. That's exactly it. Ryan Gosling.
Very smouldery face, that. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
That's a good shout. I'll do my last question, but before that, because you said it and I'm just interested, you said about you like Siddhartha because it sort of tells you what life is and you've seen a lot of life and I'm interested what you think life is. Without going 45 minutes on this, I'm kind of like, let's try and get this down to like under 10 minutes.
So I've spent a lot of time thinking about this, a combination of a lot of therapy and a lot of self-work and meditation, yoga. I'm also a qualified Kundalini yoga meditation teacher. So this is a topic that I think about a lot, maybe less so the last few years, but when I was really in the crux of my self-work phase. And for me, it's honed down to three key points. It's to love, to serve, and to grow. So to learn to love yourself first, that's key. And then to be able to be a vessel to let love out into the world. You know, it's not, love already exists. This is what one thing I've really realized. It's not about me creating love. It's there. It's always there. It's vibrating around us all the time. But what I try and do is be a vessel for that love to flow out of, and also to receive it. You know, it's a kind of, it's a process of balance. To serve, because that's why we're here. We're here to serve, to elevate, to uplift others. Would never serve anyone to just focus on themselves for personal gain. I mean, we see that happening in the greater world, and it's disastrous. You know, when we think about being part of a community, a system, you know, we are, without wanting to sound too corny, we are all one. We are literally all one, vibrating in this planet, in this cosmos at this time. If we can serve others, you know, then that's the purpose of us being here. And then to grow, yeah, so hugely, like to be able to grow in awareness and understanding why things have happened to us in different ways, to not crumble with that, to grow stronger, to heal, you know, to however we do that, whether it's through talking therapies or whether it's through action or whatever, but to know that we are all on this epic healing journey. You know, we all are, and obviously it's different degrees. I believe in reincarnation, so we've each chosen this particular body to have this experience in this particular time. So to use that to try and live the best life that we can, you know, whilst we're here. So yeah, to love, to serve, to grow. With Siddhartha, nice. What I love about that is, so our protagonist Siddhartha, he knows that there's more to life than he currently is experiencing and understands. And he goes through all these different phases of his life, from becoming a sadhu and, you know, very harsh conditions and living in the woods, to being a rich merchant, you know. And ultimately he comes to a life of simplicity, living with a riverman, and they ferry a little boat across the river. And that's their daily life. And they eat rice and mangoes, and they sit with the river, and they listen to the river, like a meditation. And that's how he comes to finally, in the end, he does, you know, find enlightenment. And it's almost like we can go on these massive searches and we can have all these outward experiences, but actually, like, the real deal, the real kind of experience is us with our breath in every moment. And I see, you know, my life, it's an ongoing journey of development and awareness. And I know that I've come so far from where I was. I remember when I finally woke up to consciousness and, you know, my mind. And I remember that was when I was about 18, and it completely floored me. I just almost, it was too much for me to comprehend. And then a few years later, it then came back, and I had enough wisdom, or not wisdom, I had enough experience to be able to hold it. But yeah, I think it's a gift, this life, and it's up to us to kind of use it in the best way that we can, given what we have been given and where we are in our life and our evolution. But yeah, to love, to serve, to grow.
That's dope. I like that. That's what you don't get that from your average Needlecraft podcast, people. Just to say that. And then finally, and I can't really, this is, again, is there an interesting fact that not a lot of people know about Kirsty MacLeod?
So the drum and bass one's probably the most people don't know that. I mean, my love of tattoos, but then I do get them out quite a lot, so people might see them. But yeah, I love
tattoos. Have you got
loads? I can show my most recent and my kind of most exciting. When the dress was completed, I got this. It goes all the way around.
Oh wow!
Yeah, and it's all hand poked. So it's like, yeah, it's like the trim of the dress. Yeah. And I've got lots of smaller ones, but I love, and I'm planning my next one. I love, I'm not so interested in kind of motifs, but it's more to do with kind of adornment and patterning. And I'm very interested in, you know, tribal markings and all the different cultures.
Are you doing your own little version of the dress there, kind of?
Yeah, I should. I was just thinking I could do the dissolving dress where I cry, and then I could release all my tattoos in 2029.
I'm worried that you might just then have to end your life, because it's like the Alpha and the Omega or something. That's remarkable. Kirsty, thank you for having a needle exchange with me.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. I've really enjoyed our chat. It's been epic, but it doesn't feel like it's even been 10 minutes. So thank you so much.